Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. Our program tonight is about our country's largest national park, Death Valley, a land known for its extreme weather, for having the lowest point in the Western Hemisphere, and for its extraordinary desert wildflowers. Our speaker tonight is Frank Ackerman, a former National Park Service Ranger who worked in Death Valley for 4 years. His 30-year career included several other posts, including the Grand Canyon and Voyageurs National Parks. He also served as the Chief of Interpretation for the Cape Cod National Seashore. Frank helped create an award-winning interpretive program as part of a joint venture between Amtrak and the National Park Service to provide educational commentary on select passenger trains in the Northeast. Most recently, he's been living in Carson City, Nevada, and working as the curator of education at the Nevada State Railroad Museum. Frank is also the study leader on the club's trip to Death Valley next March. Please join me in welcoming Frank Ackerman.
Christina, thank you very much. I want to start by mentioning three acts of Congress from a long time ago, each of which has a bearing on what I'll be talking with you about tonight. The first of these is the Mining Law of 1872, which codified the claim locating process and the system of maintaining title that was developed in the California gold camps during the gold rush days of the 1850s. And it's appropriate to that time and to the time of the silver camps on the Comstock Lode in Nevada a decade after that. And it survives today in spite of efforts to update it in its centennial year of 1972, just about the way it was originally written and passed by Congress some 140 years ago. The second law is the Antiquities Act of 1906, which is the federal statute that gave presidents of the United States the authority to proclaim national monuments from federal public domain land. And the third is the National Park Service Organic Act, which was passed August 25th, 1916. All of us who work for the Park Service have that date tattooed somewhere on our person. One of the first things you learn as a National Park Ranger is the mission set forth in that statute for the National Park Service. The job of the National Park Service is to preserve the scenery and the wildlife and historic objects, the historical and natural objects therein, by such manner and such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. That's the mandate of the National Park System. It was stated almost 100 years ago, and it stood the test of time. I think it's as valid today as it ever was. also, I might add, it's no easier in today's world than ever in the past. As Christina said, Death Valley National Park is the largest national park in the 48 contiguous states. There are some larger parks, but all of them are in Alaska. And Death Valley at almost 5,200 square miles is not only larger than Yellowstone National Park, but it's bigger than the state of Connecticut by about 175 square miles. In addition, Death Valley is larger than all three of the next three largest units of the National Park System within the state of California. That would be the Mojave National Preserve, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, which are administered by one superintendent, and the third, of course, is a place that some of you mentioned to me having been, and that's Joshua Tree National Park. Death Valley is the harshest desert environment in North America. Now, what do we mean by desert? There are two ways to define it. To a geologist, a desert's a zone of interior drainage. None of the precipitation that falls flows out of the basins and off the ranges and reaches the ocean. Climatologically, a desert is a place that receives less than 10 inches of precipitation a year, but also a place where potential evapotranspiration exceeds precipitation. In Death Valley, average annual precipitation is a little less than 2 inches a year. Average potential evapotranspiration is 12 feet. Now, in this view, we're standing on the crest of the Panamint Range at a location that's about 8,500 vertical feet above the bottom of Death Valley, which is that white expanse in the center of the photograph. I want to call your attention to what you can see in the distance. You'll notice that you've got the Amargosa Range, which forms the east wall of Death Valley, and three additional ridges beyond it. And on the far horizon, you notice that the top of the highest mountain you can see is white. You'll also notice that it's white under your feet in this view. This is a springtime picture from the crest of the Panamints at a place called Mahogany Flat, looking toward the Spring Mountains. Telescope Peak, which is the highest point in the Panamint Range, which is the mountain range on which we're standing in this photograph, is just a little more than 11,000 feet. Charleston Peak, the highest point in the Spring Mountain Range, is just a little less than 12,000 feet. Now, some of you saw this map. Here's an inset from the map that's on the easel in front of you. This map, by the way, depicts the relief and relative elevation difference of the states of California, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. Now, what we refer to as the basin and range province of North American geomorphology extends east and north from Death Valley. It's easy to pick out Death Valley because it's the area that's depicted in the same color used for the Great Valley of California on the map. And you'll notice that east of the Trench of Death Valley, there's a high mountain range near the center of the slide. It's got a white top. That's the Spring Mountains. The existence of the Great Basin has been understood for a long time. It's the largest zone of interior drainage in the continental United States. It covers nearly all of my present home state of Nevada and stretches east into central Utah, and of course west as far as the Sierra Crest. But I wanted to show you this map because back in 1884, a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, a man by the name of Clarence Dutton, described the Great Basin and its basin and range topography as looking like, on the map, and of course today from an airplane, looking like an army of caterpillars crawling toward Mexico. Now, Death Valley contains examples of every kind of terrain and surface and ecosystem that we think of as desert, from sand dunes with naked rock mountains behind them to badlands, some of them with smooth, gentle slopes like the area around Artist Drive in Death Valley, and some of them rugged like this shot of Golden Canyon, but all of them very characterized by very colorful rock formations. There's a salt pan that covers more than 200 square miles. There are box canyons in almost uncountable numbers and tremendous variety. And also there are areas of desert pavement, like this lower photograph on the left, and also dry lake beds or playas. And no, this isn't where Burning Man takes place. That would be the Black Rock Desert north of Reno. Besides the typical forms of desert terrain, there are examples of the forces that reshape the Earth's crust. Those have to do with volcanism and with faulting and earthquake movement. One of the ironies, though, of desert terrain all over the world is that the principal architect of the topography is running water and the load of angular fragments of rock that are carried by that water. And not only does the land itself get reshaped, but sometimes so do man's improvements. This is the Badwater Road just south of Furnace Creek Inn. And yes, folks, the asphalt's gone. Now, typically, rainstorms are brief, sometimes extremely heavy, but typically very localized. And one of the biological adaptations to that kind of precipitation regimen is that there are lots and lots of species of annual plants. And they manifest themselves in favorable years when there's the perfect coalescing of the amount of rainfall, the temperatures, and day length to bring us a spectacular wildflower display like this one from 2005. The animals of Death Valley also exhibit adaptation to the conditions in which they find themselves, conditions that for many species would be unforgivably hostile. But the animals that have adapted to live there do so very well and successfully make Death Valley their home. Now, of course, we associate reptiles with the desert, and the chuckwalla in this photograph typifies them. There also are birds, mammals. The mammals range from rodents up to desert bighorn sheep, and there are literally bird species of every kind. This roadrunner sort of typifies the desert for a great many of us, but the animals at the bottom of the food chain subsist on that crop of seeds from the annual plants, the rodents, the small birds, and many of the small mammals other than rodents, and of course some of the reptiles and even some amphibians. And they, of course, feed the carnivores, rattlesnakes, kit fox, coyote, and birds of prey. Probably the group of animals that's unexpected in a desert environment like Death Valley is fish. But the desert pupfish, and in the interest of full disclosure, I have to point out that this photograph is more than life size. These are extremely little fish, but they're also of tremendous scientific interest. And the reason for that is that they're the survivors of what used to be a system of interconnected freshwater lakes that drained into the Colorado River. This was back tens of thousands of years ago when glaciers covered the higher elevations in the American West. These were Ice Age lakes. And, of course, they're entirely gone. And now the pupfish survive in small bodies of surface water, such as Salt Creek. And their interest in science is sort of summarized in the name of that particular body of water, because the pupfish happen to possess the ability to adjust to tremendous changes in short periods of time of both water temperature and salinity level. And that pool at the head of Salt Creek drains in the late winter months of February and March, downstream for a considerable distance. This is spawning time for the fish. And then as the water evaporates, the flow diminishes, the pools shrink in size, and that's when the pupfish need the adaptations I was talking about a moment ago. Now, in the 1970s, when I was a park ranger in Death Valley National Monument, it was very frustrating for park visitors who visited Salt Creek, because they went to see the fish and they created conditions that prevented them from seeing what they came for. People would wade the creek looking for the fish, and of course the fish would scatter, and then as they walked along in the bottom sediment, they'd stir up sediment that would make the water turbid, and they couldn't see where they were going. But when we're there next spring, and when we're there in March of 2012, you'll see that after my time, the Park Service put in this boardwalk, which alleviated that problem. Let me shift now to the history of Death Valley. Remember, preserving the historic objects in the scenery are one of the things the Park Service is charged with doing. And much of the history of Death Valley and the historic structures in Death Valley are associated with the mining history of that part of the country. The more substantial structures, like these charcoal kilns up in the snow belt and the pinyon juniper forest on the west side of the Panamint Range, are associated with metals mining, gold, silver, tungsten. But probably the thing that the mineral that says Death Valley in the public mind was borax. And the Borax Company, and I'll refer to it that way, and later on I'll explain the evolution of its names, employed these long-line teams for about a five-year period, the initial period of borax mining and refining at Harmony Borax Works, which is that ruin that you can see in the left-hand picture at the bottom of the photograph. And two-man crews would take a pair of wagons and a water trailer, and they and their team would take 20 days to make the round trip from Harmony Borax Works, the 165 miles to the railhead at Mojave. The Harmony Borax Works wasn't photographed much when it was in operation, which was between 1882 and about 1888. But I wanted to include these photos because you'll notice white material in each of the pictures. This is borax, the raw material, the borax ore, and mining in those days consisted simply of scraping it up off the bottom of Death Valley, scraping it up off the playa surface, bringing it into the vats at Harmony Borax Works, where it was dissolved and then recrystallized in a somewhat refined state, and then bagged and hauled away. So in each of these pictures, you can see a pile of the raw material. It's more evident in the lower picture, but it's also in the one above. Now, the Borax Company left Death Valley by 1890, moved its operations to underground mines for borates in the Calico Mountains near Daggett, California. They stayed there until about 1907, and then returned to Death Valley, where borax deposits were known to occur in veins in the Badlands formations of Furnace Creek Wash. And and the flanks of the central part of the Amargosa Range, the area known as the Black Mountains, where underground mining was started in Death Valley. That lasted from 1907 until about 1925. And, of course, by this time, borax was well established in a variety of both industrial products and consumer goods. And I think a good many of us in the room tonight probably remember 20 Mule Team Borax and Boraxo. And what was the name of that actor who was on the TV show? That's correct. The governor who wasn't, the actor governor who wasn't Arnold Schwarzenegger. Anyway, by 1925, borax mining shifted again to a different part of California, this time to a place called Boron, west of Mojave. And the borax company had something else in mind for its properties in and around Death Valley. One of the things it had was this 2-foot gauge mine railroad, and instead of transporting miners, it began transporting tourists to take tours of the underground workings where borax had been taken out. Now, back in the days of the 20 mule teams, the borax company had an alfalfa farm that became known as Furnace Creek Ranch. And so the borax company redeveloped Furnace Creek Ranch for a tourist camp, and then in 1927 opened this elaborate new place of public accommodation, the Furnace Creek Inn. And the inn had all the amenities and all the architectural grandeur of the best hotels of its day. And it offered its guests opulent surroundings and a high standard of service. One of the partners for the borax company in the promotion of tourism in Death Valley was the company that moved a lot of the railroad that moved a lot of the company's freight, and that was the Santa Fe Railway, which had through train service from Los Angeles through a place called Ludlow, California, north up the Tonopah and Tidewater Railroad, a subsidiary of Pacific Coast Borax, to Death Valley Junction. And from there you traveled overland, first by narrow gauge train and then by bus to reach Furnace Creek Inn. Recall I said that the National Park Service had been created by Congress in 1916. The first director of the National Park Service was Stephen Mather, a former executive of the Borax Company. And officials of the Borax Company sought out Stephen Mather's support for the idea of making Death Valley a national park, but Mather demurred, I think, suspecting that he might be accused of a conflict of interest due to his past employment by the company. But following Mather's death in 1930, his assistant, Horace Albright, became director of the National Park Service. And February 11th, 1933, 6 weeks before he left office, President Hoover proclaimed Death Valley National Monument. And in June of that year, fulfilling an agreement that had been in place since before the proclamation of the monument, the customary provision of the Antiquities Act, which withdrew the lands of the National Monument from mineral entry, were set aside by act of Congress. And it was again possible to file mining claims in Death Valley. So here we have tourism, the preservation of nature, and mining coexisting side by side. And it was going to stay that way for more than 40 years. Now, at the same time that Furnace Creek was being redeveloped as a place to accommodate the visiting public in public facilities, something else was happening in a remote canyon 50 miles away at the extreme north end of what would be Death Valley National Monument. This elaborate hideaway in Grapevine Canyon was being constructed by a wealthy couple from Chicago. Mr. and Mrs. Albert Johnson, who were seated in their living room in this photo at what they called Death Valley Ranch. But their hideaway was known to the, in the public mind at least, as Scotty's Castle because of Albert Johnson's association with Walter Scott, Death Valley Scotty, the man in the center in this lower photograph. Now, Johnson made his money in the insurance business in Chicago, but he'd been an engineering major in college. He knew technology and knew it pretty well, and he put his knowledge to work to minimize the effects of isolation on his hideaway. First of all, he picked out the site very carefully because at 3,000 feet above sea level in a canyon, there are cooling breezes on summer afternoons and warm breezes on winter mornings to mitigate the climate somewhat. And isolated though Grapevine Canyon was, it was only 25 miles from the nearest railway station so that he could bring in furnishings and fixtures and building material manufactured from any place in the country. But he also picked out some rather interesting technological innovations to install. One of them is this solar water heater behind the main house. That's what you're looking at on the left-hand side of the photo. And that picture that we just saw was taken from the roof of the powerhouse. And here's what was inside. Death Valley Ranch had very abundant water resources. And along with using them as a water supply for domestic consumption and for irrigation purposes for landscaping, Johnson also employed them to generate electricity through this Pelton water wheel driven generating system. In 1970, using monies allocated by the Land and Water Conservation Fund Act of 1965, the National Park Service acquired Scotty's Castle. And it's a place you can visit today, and a place we'll be going in March. Also in 1970, something new was afoot once again in the Badlands up above Furnace Creek Inn. It seems that in the 1930s, the Borax Company had filed some claims that were defective in title, and when it went to refile those claims, the response from the federal government was an antitrust lawsuit, finally adjudicated in 1945 with a requirement that the Borax Company divest itself of part of its Death Valley claims. It took until 1960 to find a buyer. And the buyer of those claims was the Tenneco Oil Company. And in 1970, Tenneco began a new form of mining. Now, I want to show you this pair of maps that shows the extent of borax deposits and another mineral farther south that we'll talk about in just a few minutes. That mineral is talc. And the companies that held the claims and did the mining are shown in the map that's to the right. Now, by 1971 or thereabouts, if you stood up on Pyramid Peak in the Amargosa Range and looked out across Death Valley and Furnace Creek Wash in the immediate foreground, you would notice a hole in the ground that was getting progressively larger. Because in 1957, the technology of borax mining had shifted once again. Remember that in the 1890s, it shifted from surface scraping of evaporite deposits to underground mining in the same fashion that minerals or metals were being mined. Well, in 1957, technology changed again to open pit mining. And this is the technique that Tenneco employed at what became known as the Barraxo Mine. By the time mining finally ended, the Barraxo pit was 400 feet deep. Now, I've included a photograph at the top of this picture that contrasts the way of transporting ore in the 1970s with the way it was done 90 years earlier from Harmony Borax Works. Compare that mine truck with a pair of 20 mule team wagons. Now, along with borax mining, another mineral was being extracted, and much like borax, it was a mineral that had been extracted for many, many decades in Death Valley. At the southern end of the park, and in particular at the southern end of the Panamint Range on the west side of the park, there were groups of individually owned or family-owned talc mines that had been worked since about 1910. But a new generation of heirs for one of the groups of mining claims decided to sell. And the buyer they found was the Pfizer Corporation, which opened these surface mines for the removal of talc. And it was this kind of disturbance that awakened public activism and led to the passage of the Mining in the Parks Act of 1976, which laid the groundwork for the phasing out of mining in Death Valley. It took another 30 years for it to be accomplished, but that's when it was done. And Death Valley was relatively unique among national parks. There were only four units of the national park system that through special act of Congress were open to mineral entry, and those were Katmai and Glacier Bay National Monuments in Alaska and the upstream portions of Lake Mead National Recreation Area on the Colorado River. In 1952, President Truman had added a very important feature as a detached unit of Death Valley National Monument. Over in Nevada, there's a cavern filled with groundwater that's the habitat for an endangered species of pupfish. And at about this same time, the 1970s were an interesting time to live and work in Death Valley, as I did, because the mining controversy was at its height, and so too was the pumping of groundwater to irrigate alfalfa fields over in Nevada. This led to the prospect of extinction of the Devil's Hole pupfish. And ultimately, in 1975, I believe it was, the federal district court found in favor of the pupfish, found that federal rights to water for conservation use superseded those for the farming of alfalfa, but it wasn't before this bumper sticker appeared. Late in the 19th century, at the height of mining in Death Valley, prospectors made use of burros as the means of transporting their supplies and equipment. And oftentimes, when the prospector was done, he'd simply turn the animal loose. And that led to the creation of a free-ranging population of feral burros. And they, of course, multiplied because they're natives of the Middle East. And here they are in an ecosystem very much like the country in which they evolved, but there isn't any natural regulation of their numbers through disease or predation. And so they were at a competitive advantage over the native species, not only for forage, but especially for water. This is a fairly typical picture of one of the water sources, a spring in the Grapevine Mountains, in the summertime condition. Now there's water in this picture. Can you find it? Now, the species most affected by competition from feral burros was the desert bighorn sheep. And on behalf of the sheep, the Park Service and other wildlife conservation agencies instituted measures to exclude burros from water supplies that were critical to the survival of bighorn and also from some areas of forage. The principal tool was fencing. Let's step ahead to 1994. This was the year of the passage of the California Desert Protection Act, which established the Mojave National Preserve, upgraded Joshua Tree and Death Valley from national monuments to national parks, dramatically increased the area of both Joshua Tree and Death Valley. One of the areas that was added to Death Valley was to Death Valley National Park was the Eureka Valley, the site of the tallest dune field in the state of California. Also added were Saline Valley, Greenwater Valley, and a substantial part of Panamint Valley, plus the mountain ranges that fringe all of those basins. And another feature of the law was establishment of wilderness for large areas within the national parks and on adjoining tracts of Bureau of Land Management land in the California desert. You recall I said at the beginning of the program that the new area of Death Valley National Park was enlarged to 5,200 square miles. And of that nearly 5,200 square miles, more than 4,900 square miles are set aside as wilderness. Basically, all of the park that isn't already developed or identified as an access corridor. That includes the last 1,000 feet of the Panamint Range, the last 1,000 vertical feet of Telescope Peak where these bristlecone pines live, but it also includes every other kind of habitat and every other elevation within the park, in the canyon country, and all the way down to the floor of Death Valley. 4,900 square miles that are now an enduring research resource of wilderness, or at least so we hope. Conservation requires continual vigilance. It's not something that remains done. So each new generation faces its challenges, just as my generation faced hours in the 1970s. And with that, I want to thank you very much.
Some questions from the audience, so I will pass around the microphone. Just raise your hand up if you have a question that you'd like to ask.
I remember borax and mutein, whatever, but I can't remember what borax is.
Well, it's an evaporite compound, and it's sometimes boron in combination with sodium carbonate. Sometimes it's boron in combination with calcium carbonate and a number of molecules of water. Well, it's used as a cleaning agent. Boric acid is very effective as an insecticide. It's roach powder, for example. Because of course it's poisonous, and the roaches will walk through the powder and then clean their feet, and then their feet are up in the air. At least that's the idea. Now, one of the consequences of the poisonous properties of boron is that it's had its use as a fire retardant has been stopped because it produces soil sterility. And the U.S. Forest Service found out the hard way that, yes, it puts the fire out, but it prevents you from reforesting. So borate bombing as a forest firefighting tool is a thing of the past. But boron's present in trace amounts in a lot of industrial products, paints, for example. Anyone else?
Yeah, thank you for the excellent presentation. Obviously, Death Valley is protected as a national park and the laws that you cited, but I'm curious, going into the future, what do you see the biggest challenges to Death Valley as far as continued preservation?
Well, one of the things that is and remains a concern is the fact that the current form of mining, if you will, is the mining of fossil water. There's a tremendous resource of groundwater. It's not always of good quality. But one of the things that those of you who come on the trip will see is a reverse osmosis water treatment plant at a development called Stovepipe Wells Village. And that was put in the 1970s by the National Park Service. And one of its implications is if you can take saline groundwater, make it drinkable through reverse osmosis, what are the limits on development of the desert? I don't know the answer, but I'm perfectly happy to raise the question. And then other factors involve things like the migration of air pollution from urban centers. There was noticeable diminution in air quality, again, as early as the 1970s in Death Valley National Park. And it was attributable to the urbanization, the growing urbanization of Southern California and of Las Vegas. So, and then, of course, technology changes everything. I've described in brief outline the evolving technology of mining. One of the things that perpetuated mining in Death Valley was the fact that as technology changed, ore deposits that had been marginal became profitable. Ore deposits that had been totally unprofitable became at least marginal. And led to presumption that eventually they too would become profitable. So technological change is something that anyone involved in conservation must pay attention to and be prepared to adjust to and respond to. Another example, and this is not from Death Valley, but from my days at Cape Cod National Seashore. When I first went there in the early 1980s, driving a four-wheel drive vehicle on the beach was something done predominantly by surf fishermen. And nobody could foresee the tremendous explosion in numbers of the sport utility vehicle. So technological change and the challenges it presents take a lot of different forms and a lot of different frames of reference. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I noticed a couple of pictures with bighorn sheep. I wondered if there was any game hunting, citizen game hunting in Death Valley.
Not in the national park. there are bighorn sheep that huddled populations of bighorn sheep, including desert bighorn, do exist. But not within the national park. In part because it's a national park, but also in part because that particular population is recognized and listed as an endangered population. Now, you understand that an animal species overall may or may not be considered endangered in all parts of its range. Did that?
What is the status of the burro population? And also, when we're there, what do we expect as a temperature? How hot will it be?
Well, when we're there in mid-March, the temperature should be delightful. Now, that said, delightful is in the... yes. Well, I remember an ad that ran in Sunset Magazine when the Fred Harvey Company was operating Furnace Creek Inn and Furnace Creek Ranch. And the tagline for the print ad was, "The most wonderful summer I ever spent was winter in Death Valley." And the nights are cool, not frigid in the fashion that some deserts in other parts of the world are, but because one of the characteristics of desert in general and Death Valley in particular is that there's not a lot of vegetation. When you're out in the open parts of the park, there's a lot of re-radiation of sunlight from the ground. So this part of you is being warmed by the sun, and your shins are being warmed by what's coming off the ground. now, but that said, I think that if you do as we tell you to, wear your hat, apply your sunscreen, and take advantage of the opportunities to share the liberal supply of drinking water we'll provide, you'll have an enjoyable time. As to the burros, we probably will not see burros in March because we'll be at the lower elevations. They typically are up in the mountains where there's more abundant forage. There's an attempt to coexist. You know, the recognition is that eradication of the burro population is not biologically possible. And so the question of striking a balance is...
Didn't they use borax in concrete also?
You know, that's possibly true. I'm not sure, but it might be.
You mentioned several minerals, and I was wondering whether there are any rare earth minerals in Death Valley that are of interest to Silicon Valley. And they are looking at the rare earths, the zirconium oxides, the titanium oxides, and I know there's a big hunt on all over the world. That would be a big scare.
Yeah, is it true that most of the rare earths that exist at Africa, I was going to say China was what I had heard, was, yeah.
I'm sure we want to find them here.
Yeah. I'm not aware that there are any. One thing that did happen in Death Valley was that there were marginal deposits of tungsten that became economical to mine because the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission in the 1950s had a subsidy program for the stockpiling of strategic metals. And that led to federally sponsored mining in the national park, in effect. Kind of like agricultural price supports for tobacco farmers when the Attorney General had the notices on the cigarette packages, if I can draw an analogy. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry?
The biggest threat facing Death Valley now
is, yes, depending on the form it takes. As I said, what can happen, and the events at Devil's Hole in a way typify this on a small scale. You can withdraw water You can withdraw from a lens of groundwater at one extremity and have it drawn down throughout.
You mentioned the things that people need to do for the hot weather. Is there adaptations or whatever required for vehicles or other machinery?
One of the things that's been a practice for decades for the National Park Service is to provide tanks of radiator water on the grades climbing out of Death Valley. And there also are instructions that are printed and circulated by the park rangers and at the visitor center regarding how to keep your vehicle from overheating. But the major thing is be sure you have water for the radiator in the car and a few common sense things like don't take the radiator cap off. Use your fan to cool the radiator core. But, and lest I forget, when you're going uphill, turn off the air conditioning. But in terms of things to do for vehicles, generally no. I mean, it's these set of precautionary measures. I have to apologize because I've lived in Nevada for 6 years. Shortly after I moved there, I went to my allergist and had skin tests and learned that I'm allergic to our state flower, sagebrush. So I'm going to have another balls. Yes.
How would you characterize the level of tourism currently, and would you consider that a threat to a fragile ecosystem?
No, I would say it's not a threat to the ecosystems because of the car-bound behavior of American tourists. One of the salvations of the national park system is that 99% of all the visitors, or maybe it's 99.9% of all the visitors, don't get farther than 50 feet from the center line of a paved road. If I sound flip, I apologize, but that really is a salvation of the resources of the parks. And as such, it minimizes the adverse effect of human presence. Except in areas like the withdrawal of water. And that's the sort of thing that has the potential to alter entire ecosystems from some distance away.
Anybody else?
What would the average temperature be, the range in March?
I knew I should have printed out that handout from the Park Service that would help me answer this question. But average maximum temperatures, I'm guessing, are going to be in the 90s.
That would be high.
Okay.
I mean, the range is, you can have anywhere from 70 to 90.
This gentleman's name also is Ackerman. This is Fred Ackerman, born in Lone Pine, California, while his father was stationed at Furnace Creek. Okay, thank you very much.
And for those of you that are going, sorry, Fred is also our tour leader on the trip. So we've got a father-son team going with us. I have one question for you. I don't know if you had something else. Just when you were bringing up the Badlands, you gave us a definition of what a desert is.
Mm-hmm.
What defines something when people say the Badlands?
Well, typically Badlands are easily eroded rock formations. In Death Valley, they take the form of lake bed deposits. And because they're easily eroded, soil accumulation on top of the rock is minimal, as it is everywhere in the desert for that matter. But vegetation doesn't gain much of a foothold. So these are bad lands. The term was originally coined to describe areas that have little or no agricultural potential, even though there might be sufficient rainfall. Now, it just so happens that there also can be minerals present. Boron is one example. Selenium is another. And how do these materials get in these lake bed deposits to begin with? The answer is volcanism. These are substances deposited in volcanic ash and bodies of water.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. Thank you very much, Frank Ackerman.